I am Carlos Reutemann. Please listen F1 Weekly.
There are fewer than 30 men in the world qualified to drive Formula One. A mere half dozen, perhaps, to win. At this moment, I'm inclined to think you're not one of them.
No, you want to.
Keep up the good work, Stephen, and there you have it. There you go.
Hello, this is Desiree for F1Weekly.com. I'm your in-depth correspondent.
Let's go with the qualifying, Steve.
Welcome to F1Weekly.com. My name is Clark Rogers. I'm the host of the program. I'll be joined by Nasser Hamid, my co-host. This is podcast number 837, June 22nd. 2020, Nasser.
Thank you, sir. As Andy Williams would say, almost there. How wonderful F1 will be for me and you and everybody. Now back to Mr. Quincy Jones of podcasting.
Thank you, Nasser. On today's programs, is LCH the new real leader of Formula One? Ryan Blaney wins Talladega, and I'm telling you, that was an exciting finish when they're crashing. Third place is picked up by the back end of a car. That is machismo. And come on, folks, it is Alabama. I got more from Gary Sloan in thepitlane.com. This week's vintage interview, Carlos Reutemann. And I want to remind everybody, we need your contributions to keep this program on the air. Just click on the Support F1 Weekly tab. You know you want to. Anyone who donates more than $100 will receive the F1 Weekly Coffee Cup of the Century. Nass, welcome to the studio. How are you, my friend?
Oh, we are friends. That's good. I'm doing very good, sir. Thank you. How are things in Cali?
Cali is calm, cool, and collected.
Well, don't tell me that the Clark Rogers statue at the French Park has been brought down or not brought down. I need an update on the Clark Rogers statue.
The Clark Rogers statue has been removed in the middle of the night and placed in a secure location due to my extremely controversial, how would you say it, outlook on the racing industry.
There you go, sir. Yeah. Next time I'm in Cali, I would like to at least take a look at it one more time. And I'm sure you have a big mirror in front of it, right?
Of course, a deep dish mirror, sir.
There you go, sir. But sir, you know, before we go anywhere on the Formula One situation, we would like to wish all the best and speedy recovery to Alex Zanardi. I'm sure you heard about his big accident. He lost control of his hand bike and crashed into a truck, unfortunately suffering serious head injuries and had to be airlifted to a hospital. I really cannot believe the tenacity and spirit of this man. I saw him at Daytona in January in his wheelchair, or maybe it's called a hand bike. And man, anybody who wants to be an M in life should look at this restless and very dynamic and successful spirit. Yes, Formula One was not kind to him, but he had a great run of success in IndyCar racing. When he was a kid, his sister was killed along with her boyfriend in a car accident. He has gone through some testing times in life. His positive attitude is absolutely remarkable, and I hope he is back in action and home soon. Your thoughts on Alex Zanardi's situation, sir?
Very tough. I was stunned. I was going, please, not another 2020 disaster that I need in front of my brain. And I suggest that everybody read Alex Zanardi's book. It's very inspiring because of it's just, there's no magic pill. It's simple, hard work. I mean, full dedication. And this man, sure. Yeah, he was teammates to Half Schumacher. It was a little tough at Williams. We all thought he was going to succeed. It didn't happen. You know what? He took lemons and made lemonade. Alex Zanardi is an unbelievable person, and I really hope that he comes out of this healthy and fine.
Yes, sir. Very well said. And when I first saw, I said, you know, I was not aware of any. I thought he was in, because he has been doing some car races also, especially with BMW lately. And that's what he was driving at Daytona. And so I was kind of surprised. I said, you know, there's no racing going on that I was aware of. And then I read it was a, you know, this handbike accident. So very sad, and I hope it works out for him. Sir, moving on, talking of almost there, opening round of the 2020 season is happening within 2 weeks. More of the same is expected, but before we talk more of the same, the excitement you show about the NASCAR race at Talladega, I think that has exceeded your excitement on the result of the 2000 San Marino Grand Prix. So what's going on here?
Now, wait a minute. It's not exactly Imola and the Red Baron against El Machismo, but I'm telling you, it's the best. I mean, I don't really understand why they have three stages. I don't understand a lot of stuff, but I do understand caution, crashing, and winning, and racing. And I'm telling you, this last lap is absolute. Well, first, there's a caution with three laps to go. One lap is behind the pace car, so there's two laps to go. It's exciting. It's a run. They go for it. And I'm telling you, I'm sure it's on YouTube. You got to see this finish. It's a photo finish. It's exciting. And hey, I'm desperate for racing, and I'll take whatever I can get, Nass.
No, same here. And I have to say that any 10, 20 laps of a NASCAR race or oval race, IndyCars or Hot 100, whatever, it is very, very exciting from a pure racing point of view. No question about that. Okay, sir, are you excited about Formula One in Austria in about 10, 11 days?
It's going to be exciting. I am telling you, I cannot wait. I'm going to be completely immersed. I'm going to be drinking Austrian wine. I'm going to be drinking Austrian soft drinks. I'm going to be eating Austrian food. I'm going to speak German all weekend long.
Sounds like you're spending the weekend with Max Mosley.
Bravo.
Yes, he speaks German. And you know, he's very orderly.
Yeah, but you're thinking of a more... It's a completely different kind of German. The cadence is a little different. It's very...
Keep in mind, Adolf was at his father's wedding.
Exactly. His father was a great, respected fascist supporter.
So there you have it, sir, on his German heritage.
I'm really glad we brought this up.
Oh, absolutely. You know, it's we're global kind of people, you know. We look at things from, as Mr. Andy Williams would say, both sides now. But, sir, moving back on track, we are expecting more of the same. But today, let's take a contrarian look and see what are the chances of the Weber deal, multi 2-1, where number two becomes numero uno. It has happened a few times in our lifetime and in Formula One history, but it's a little difficult though. So we shall start with the Mercedes team. The Silver Arrows, performing for the last several years more like Silver Bullet. The trigger man is your favorite driver, Lewis Hamilton. In 6 months, he may equal Michael Schumacher's number of titles and may surpass his unbelievable record of 91 Grand Prix wins. At one time, I thought Sebastian Vettel will do that, but different story now. This is the formidable challenge faced by his wingman, Valtteri Bottas. Bottas got a fresh supply of oxygen bottle recently after he was told Seb is not on Toto's radar. Since becoming Lewis's teammate, now and then he has beaten LCH fair and square, both in quali and races. His drive in Baku last season was a great example. He will need double-digit Bakus in a season to become world champion. Even a 45-point lead had been overcome by his teammate against the man Bottas replaced, and I'm sure you remember that incident. According to his own statement, he is best prepared for any of his F1 seasons. And that's saying quite a lot. Basically, on the Jean Alesi program, a lot of new motivation. What he really needs is Rosberg luck in the opening races, like Icablamo on Lewis's car, a pit call disaster, LCH taken out in one race by Max, and then in the next race by Charles and Vala. Or maybe by Max Albon, Karma, and Vala, Valtteri Bottas wins the first four races. With all that's going on in this world and Lewis being very vocal about it, which you alluded to at the start of the podcast, he may also appear on tracks with new motivation. If the season is less than 15 races, then Bottas will have the best and final opportunity to become world champion. I think his chances are better than Rubinho over Schumi. My two pesos on this, if both Lewis and Bottas finish equal number of races, advantage car number 44. So the question for you, Mr. Host, under what reasonable possible scenario can Bottas be world champion this year?
Well, first I have to do this. Car 44, where are you? That's what Bottas is going to do, because he's going to be blown away by LCH. I hate to say it, but LCH is pumped up. He has a purpose. Now he has social reasons to fight. He's got a whole world to change. So LCH is going to be a little bit tough on the track, and I hate to tell you this, but Bottas will receive a text message from Rubinho.
What will the message say?
It will say, "Welcome to my world."
Yes. Okay, sir, now we move on to the most magical name in the world of motor racing, Scuderia Ferrari. At the end of the season, Seb is taking the last train to Clarksville from Maranello. And the question being asked is, will he obey team orders? He may be well-mannered and cultured and a good family man. Put him in a competitive race car, he is a different animal. Feisty in nature. Malaysia, Baku, Turkey, Abu Dhabi. Need I say more? It will be quite an achievement to outrace Scuderia's new sensation on his way out. But stranger things have happened in Formula One. I think there will be firestorms and meltdowns among the Reds. Frankly, I do not expect great team spirit from Seb, especially when he thinks he has a chance to win the race. And I would, as far as team spirit is concerned, I think I can say the same thing about Charles, which good driver wants to lose a race that he can win. And Signor Binotto cannot seem to lay down the law like Signor Briatore. If there is a number two who can prevail over his teammate this season, I think that man is Sebastian Vettel. What do you think, Mr. Rogers?
I hate to say this, but Sebastian Vettel will be like a wounded lion. Dangerous, but making lots of mistakes. And the mistakes have not stopped. Vettel's big problem, too many mistakes last year, too many mistakes the year before. Therefore, now that he's wounded, and you're right, sportsmanship is out the window. We're back to multi-21. Mark Webber will be texting everybody, and I'm telling you, it's going to be ugly. And like you said, I believe that Charles Leclerc not only will be hip and happening as a man with lots of culture, I'm not too thrilled about that movie they made replacing Rendezvous, but nevertheless, Vettel is out, Leclerc is in, and I'm telling you, it's going to get ugly, like you said. There will be instances where all of us will say, what a sad, sad situation. I don't want to compare Vettel to a political figure that's on his way out and his rally was sort of a dud, but it's somewhat similar. Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Clark Biden. Nice meeting you. Okay. I'll tell you what, Mr. Rogers, like I said last year a few times, with the scenario you just played out between the two Ferrari drivers, I will say what I was saying last season. Looks like everybody wants Lewis Hamilton to win another championship, because he'll be the biggest beneficiary if these people take out each other.
I completely agree. I mean, we're not going to have much racing, but the racing we're going to have in 2020 is going to be like an espresso. It's going to be jam-packed full of flavor.
Yes, sir. It will be like total andale, andale. Okay, now we come to Red Bull. In this abattoir, only one bovine is safe, the Max kind. Alexander Elbon did a great job last year after Dr. Marco moved him into Gasly C at the mothership. The kid has not even made it to the podium as yet. Thank you, LCH. So to expect him to topple Max Verstappen is not even in any Bollywood script. Hopefully he will earn his first podium in 2020. I have a feeling this year Max will win more races than Bottas. Do you concur, sir?
I do not. I believe that this year Red Bull may suffer from GP2 engines. Ah!
I'm glad you said that, not me. GP2 engine. Oh boy. And what a comeback Honda Racing had when he won his first race, a second race last year. They put out on their Instagram, that's GP2 wins. Oh, the slings and arrows. Okay, sir, now we come. Oh, I have a question for you. Do you think Albon will get a podium this season?
He will get one podium.
Yeah, I think so. I agree. I agree, sir. Now we come to McLaren. They have a fire sale also going, by the way. Carlos Sainz Jr. and Lando Norris may well be racing for Kawasaki team. Let the good times roll. Carlito has a big season and contract after 2020. And Norris, who came into F1 after winning 5 of 6 championships he raced in, is staying with the team, only to be joined what can be termed as major headache next season. Last year, Lando was impressive in quali, but Carlito had his number on race day. The advantage of more experience should help Sainz Jr. in keeping ahead of his teammate, but Lando should take a leap in performance this year and surprise the Spaniard and many others. Opportunity is there for sure. Your call on the two McLaren men.
I think Lando Norris is going to be good, but Sainz is all over it. Sainz is pumped up. He's got a Ferrari contract. And when you got a Ferrari contract, you're drinking a lot of olive oil and you're going fast. You're slipping and sliding. He is the dude. Sainz Jr. is going to kick some booty at McLaren this year.
Any podium for McLaren drivers this season?
You betcha.
Okay, that's it. I think so too. Maybe they'll luck out in a race or two. But we'll have to see first how the package is for these teams. Now we come to Alfa Romeo. If you were a young racing talent and handed opportunity of a lifetime to make a name in Formula One, you must beat the oldest man on the grid, plus a driver who is already a few years past his sell-by date. Antonio Giovinazzi, please say hello to Kimi Raikkonen. Joey was looking good in the second half of the season last year, except at Spa. I would like to see him outscore and outrace Kimi all season, and hopefully keep the hope of getting into Scuderia Ferrari next season. Talking of these two guys, do you think Joey will prevail over Kimi, and will Kimi stay beyond this season?
I think Kimi is going to surprise once again. He's so calm. He saves so much energy for the race. Nobody can compete with that calmness until he gets in the car. And then it's leave me alone, I know what I'm doing.
That's very true. Now we come to your homeboys, Renault. Danny Boy knows he does not have the package to beat Mercedes and Red Bull, or even Ferrari. This means he will be fighting to get into the top 5 and not the podium, which is where he belongs, based on his talent. And then at the end of the season, he is saying bye-bye to Cyril Abitbol. Is he going to care too much about how the season goes and how the team performs? I say no, but the racer in him might disagree with me. His teammate at the French team is the local flavor, Esteban Ocon, very talented, and claim to fame is he won the European Formula 3 championship over Max Verstappen. But since then, there has been some push and shove between the two. Question is, how will Esteban do against Daniel Ricciardo? I think the Aussie mate will have the upper hand in the first half, or should I say in the first 3 months of the season. And by then or after then, it is up to Esteban to do to him what Ricciardo did to Sebastian at Red Bull, which was absolutely mind-blowing. I don't see Danny Boy as the kind of driver who will say French team was favoring a French driver, unless his teammate was a young whippersnapper, Alain Prost. I am not expecting any wins by any of the Renault drivers, but I am expecting to see a Shuey on the podium in a few races. What say you, mate?
I'm worried about Renault. We'll see what happens, but they got the green light from the big bosses at the top, which is hard to do when you're losing billions and billions, but they did. I think Danny is going to impress on his last year. I think Renault is going to show performance. Other than that, I really don't give a damn.
Okay, now we come again back to your favorite driver, Lewis Hamilton. Check this out. I hope it does not happen, but then again, that's just of my opinion. Apparently, according to reports, Lewis Hamilton is planning to kneel during the Austrian national anthem, which of course will mark the beginning of the long delayed Formula One season here this season. And apparently this gesture has the backing of his team. And apparently FIA is also cool with it. You know, my point is this problem he is referring to, the Minnesota issue. Minnesota is in America, not in Austria. You know what I'm saying? But that's just my personal opinion. And that's all I can say. Would you have any thoughts on this, sir?
I do have some thoughts on this. Briefly, you're right. Minnesota is not in Austria. And I think we need to keep sports and politics. I mean, they do go hand in hand. But Mr. Lewis Hamilton, you've become an extremely rich man with this sport. Just get in and race. And then go fight for your political causes, for human rights causes, on your own time. And that's how I prefer it. But he's trending, he's Kaepernicking, and that's the way it is.
So, Mr. Rogers, I totally agree with you. Politics and religion should not be brought into sports. You know, there are different places for different events in life, and do what you need to do in those places. But this is just personal opinion, okay? And the thing about Lewis, you know, is the way I look at these things is this, and I appreciate what he's doing, and I understand why he's doing. But, you know, I also look at it this way. If you are pushing for diversity, which he is, okay, he must have made maybe $400 million. And he's not the only one who has made that kind of money. What I want to know, how much of that money he has paid to help another kid, a minority kid from Stevenage or some other black kid in England or some minority that he so wants to, they should be given the opportunity. So these are some of the questions I have. And the other thing is, you know, he's a tremendous, tremendous racing talent. And once you get into the political arena of things, you say things, we see just in racing, you say things that are taken out of context, and then you say, oh, I'm sorry, that's not what I meant. And if he gets too involved in this, sooner or later, there will be, you know, slings and arrows flying, and then he may get on the TV Rape One program, caught in the crossfire. And the only fire we want him is on the racetrack. That's all.
Why don't we hear from Gary Sloan now, baby?
Hello, listeners. My name's Gary Sloan. This is this week's edition of In the Pit Lane. So as COVID-19 leaves a trail of human misery and economic ruin in its path, an awful lot of people are getting upset that Lewis Hamilton is telling the world his opinion on everything from the environment, racism, and the price of baked beans. Some argue Lewis should only comment on issues relating to motor racing, but huge numbers of Formula One fans are interested in what he has to say. Back in 2017, Formula One decided to do a survey, and they contacted more than 14,000 people in 7 different countries in a bid to understand just how much sports fans are invested in Formula One. What they found was Formula One was an incredibly rich sport, mixing many elements, including technology, human interest, heroism, and glamour into a really exciting package. However, different elements appeal to different people, and while some are entranced by the technology, others focus on the human story of the driver's rivalries, or the glamour of the location, the personalities and the celebrities. What the survey confirmed to Formula One is that no two fans are the same. Every fan interacts with the sport in different ways, and it's Formula One's job to deliver a sport that appeals to the particular interest of all their fans. So Lewis is actually part of the solution for Formula One to continually engage with fans on all levels, to keep the sport relevant in this ever-changing world. Of course, it's not always been the case. When one Bernie Ecclestone was in charge of the show, he certainly didn't embrace the digital world. He did not understand it, did not get it, More importantly, he could not see a way of making money from it. He was a TV guy, full stop. To show how much out of touch he'd become, back in 2014, he suggested Formula One did not need an official social media presence, because he felt platforms like Twitter and Facebook had no future. At the time, he said, "I'm not interested in tweeting, Facebook, and whatever this nonsense is." And in an attempt to put the genie back in the bottle, back in 2016, he banned Lewis Hamilton, who was one of the first drivers to fully embrace social media, from using Snapchat in the paddock. Lewis, of course, completely ignored this. Then, when Lewis started taking clips of his onboards and posting them onto his Instagram channel, he received endless cease and desist letters from Bernie Ecclestone's lawyers. But again, Lewis chose to ignore them. There's a staggering fact which demonstrates Lewis Hamilton's reach. If we look at the number of followers on Instagram, which is the platform of choice for Formula One drivers, if we leave Lewis out of the equation for a moment and add up all the followers of the other 19 drivers on the 2020 grid, their total amounts to 16.5 million. Lewis alone has 16.8 million. I think that says it all. On a footnote, it's well known that Bernie Ecclestone and Sebastian Vettel are friends, often playing a game of backgammon together. But conversation topics surely won't include social media, as Vettel has exactly zero followers after he's refused to personally engage with social media, instead leaving that to Ferrari. Well, that's it for another week. More details at inthepitlane.com. Until next week, stay safe, stay well.
Gary, keep up the good work.
Okay, sir. What else shall we talk? Oh, by the way, he did post on his Instagram that he is heartbroken by the loss of his bulldog, Coco. Coco and Roscoe have been to more races than you and me.
Wow.
Our sympathies to him on that death in the family. Okay, sir, now we are turning Japanese. I really think so. The name is Juju Noda. She is 14 years old and daughter of ex-F1 driver Hideki Noda. And I'm sure you remember Hideki Noda.
Oh, yeah.
Roger-san, as you know, at the longest-running Formula One podcast, we love to follow and find young, you know, racing stars who will be stars of the future. I mean, you know, we brought Charles Leclerc on F1 Weekly Palatial Studios when he was still in karting. So we're very happy about that. She came on my radar last year. And when I was at the Abu Dhabi Grand Prix last year, I was talking to a Dutch fan who was, of course, a proud member of the Orange Brigade. And he also brought up this kid's name, making a big impression in Japanese racing. Now, fast forward to 2020 and the first single-seater race of this season. That was the round one of the Danish Formula 4 Championship. And Juju goes for it, winning the race from pole position with authority. And this really brings it to the point of minorities and others who are not well represented. And I did not live in 1855, but living in 2020, the opportunities that are available through Red Bull and McLaren Ferrari driver development program, if you have the talent, you will get to the top. There is no question in my mind, but it has to be Max-like, Lewis-like, Nando-like, Seb-like, Ayrton Senna-like, Schumi-like. And that's what we want at the top. We don't want, I'm not going to drop names here, but we don't want drivers running not like number two, but like number four to a fast driver. You know what I'm talking about? Roger-san, as you know, at the longest-running Formula One podcast, we love to follow and find young, you know, racing stars who will be stars of the future. I mean, you know, we brought Charles Leclerc on F1 Weekly Palatial Studios when he was still in karting. So we're very happy about that. She came on my radar last year, and when I was at the Abu Dhabi Grand Prix last year, I was talking to a Dutch fan who was, of course, a proud member of the Orange Brigade, and he also brought up this kid's name, making a big impression in Japanese racing. Now, fast forward to 2020 and the first single-seater race of this season. That was the round one of the Danish Formula 4 Championship, and Juju goes for it, winning the race from pole position with authority. And this really brings it to the point of minorities and others who are not well represented. And I did not live in 1855, but living in 2020, the opportunities that are available through Red Bull and McLaren Ferrari driver development program, if you have the talent, you will get to the top. There is no question in my mind. But it has to be Max-like, Lewis-like, Nando-like, Seb-like, Ayrton Senna-like, Schumi-like. And that's what we want at the top. We don't want, I'm not going to drop names here, but we don't want drivers running not like number two, but like number four to a fast driver. You know what I'm talking about?
Well, I know about Hitco and Brembo and Carbon Industries.
Oh, yeah. Thank you, Mr. Peter Windsor.
Grazie. Mille grazie. Okay, now, speaking of great talent, it's time for the Vintage Interview of the Week. And, of course, Carlos Reutemann, you went to a lot of trouble to get this interview, Nass.
Nasser?
Thank you, sir. First of all, I would like to say muchas gracias to Senor Reutemann for his time. Very kind of him to come to my hotel for this conversation, which took place in Buenos Aires. Reutemann is one of only three drivers who started their F1 career from pole position. He won races for Brabham, Ferrari, and Williams, and gave Michelin their first ever victory in Formula One. This is a fascinating story of a kid who dreamed of Formula One while growing up on a farm in Santa Fe, Argentina. Special thanks to three important people who made this meeting possible: Mrs. Veronica Reutemann, Javier Naselli, who is also from Argentina and currently working in New York and put me in touch with the Reutemann familia, and my friend and Argentine F1 journalist, Ms. Juliana Anish. So please enjoy a chat with a Grand Prix great, and thank you.
Okay, folks, I'm here in Buenos Aires with a gentleman who started his Grand Prix career from pole position and won three Formula One races in the United States alone, Mr. Carlos Alberto Reutemann. Great to meet you. How are you today, sir?
Okay. Nice to meet you, and nice to receive you here in Buenos Aires, and coming from the States and coming to make few questions for sure about racing, something like that.
Great pleasure and honor to be here. And before we talk about your great career, which I enjoyed very much, may I get your opinion, please, on Formula One?
So I am quite happy at my time in Formula One. It was very hard to arrive in and driving in Formula One. It was a very hard time for us, living from South America, and was very hard to driving in Europe and starting in Formula 2 at the time, and was always was difficult to arrive to the point to arrive one Formula 1. So I am very lucky to drive in few years in Formula 1. I'm very lucky to drive in Formula 1. I'm very lucky to be alive.
That is true. There is a very good website dedicated to your racing life. It's from a gentleman in Argentina. And you were quoted as saying, "I went from going to school on a horseback to driving a Grand Prix car for Ferrari." Certainly a great journey. Tell us a little bit about your early days growing up in Santa Fe and how you got the racing bug.
You're absolutely right. One day, I answered the same question. And I remember when I was a child, I went to the school in the horse. Because I live in the farming area, I was a small school for the people living in the farmer areas. And so we live in the farm, and the school was in one place for about 50 people from the farms went to the school, and Few people went in the horse, a lot of people going in the bicycle, a lot of people went in the motorbike. So for me it was, I make every day 3 miles going to the school and 3 miles to coming back. So was a very sacrificed life and was very hard when in the middle of the travel to the school coming a big thunderstorm with lightings and big thunderstorm was, I remember always, was very dangerous.
How did you get the nickname which you were always known in racing, Lole?
Lole, this is because it's the farming area. People farming in the farming start to call me Lole about a nickname coming from the farming area.
Okay.
Yeah.
How did you discover Formula One living in a farming area?
I follow at the time I living in the farm. I follow motor racing, but the local motor racing, and it's a very special form of motor racing. ¿Cuánto te debo?
28.
In Argentina was at the time of Fangio and the Galvez and people for racing in the roads in Turismo de Carretera. So we follow all these people. When I was a child, I follow this type of racing, and I love racing because I follow these people. But at the time, I'm talking about 1950s.
I can stop if you want to eat.
No, it's okay.
Was your dad interested in motor racing? Okay.
No.
How old were you when you decided to pursue racing as a professional career, and were mom and dad happy with your decision?
I remember I was 7 years old when I started to driving in the farmer tractor. Mm-hmm. So my daddy was very impressive because I was so small, so young, 7 years old, very small. Mm-hmm. And I started to drive in the tractor and a small car we have in the farm. And the farm is very easy to drive in because you're feeling very free.
It's not a lot of runoff area.
Yeah. And on a wrong area, no police, nothing. So at the age of 10 or 12 years old, I drive in normal car in the middle of the farm with no problem, no tickets, no police, and a lot of run of area. And he used to driving in the dirt. Driving in the dirt, you get a lot of driving control of the car when the car is going sideways.
Safe to assume you were driving as a 10-year-old very quick?
No, but I have facility for driving. Facility, you understand?
Yeah.
Natural driver.
Yeah. Now, you were 9 years old when Maestro won his first world championship. When was the first time you saw Fangio race at a track, and did you ever approach him for racing advice for your career?
I followed Juan Manuel Fangio's career when I was in the school, but followed by the newspapers. Because at the time, no was a communication of today. Today you see everything in internet or in television. At the time, we live in Argentina, and the performance of Fangio in Europe coming with the radio or with the newspaper. You understand? It's no chance to see Fangio racing in television.
Okay. Racing has always been very expensive. Who were the key people behind your racing career leading up to your arrival in Europe?
in 1969, the ACA, the Automobile Club of Argentina, decided to organize a Formula 2 team in Europe in 1970. So the ACA in Argentina, the Automobile Club of Argentina, organized a team in Europe with the Brabham Formula 2 team. Mm-hmm. When Jack Brabham have the factory in Weybridge in England, and so we went to race in Formula 2 in 1970. To Formula 2, Brabham Formula 2 engine, Cosworth engine, about 220 horsepower.
Now, Formula 2, European Formula 2 was very serious cutthroat competition. Formula 1 drivers would come and race. What was your first impression of the European racing compared to what you were used to in Argentina?
First time I went to Formula 2 racing in Europe was like a day and night compared with the time we were racing in Argentina. I remember time 1970 driving in Formula 2, Rin, Schiffer, Pierre Courage, Seder. Very good driver, very quick drivers, all very quick drivers, and very competitive. Very difficult to get inside with these people, eh? Very difficult.
Yeah. Now, I know you finished second in the championship to Ronnie Peterson, but before that second season was over in Formula 2 for you, was there a race or event in Europe where you had a performance where you felt, you know, I can make it in Formula 1, I can beat these guys?
Took long time to me to get to the level of the competition of the top drivers. Takes long time. Takes a lot of miles and a lot of experience. I think in the end of 1971, you make a comparison with Ronnie Peterson or Emerson Fittipaldi or François Sever racing the Tecno. So at the time I fight for the championship. So in the end of 1971. You have the impression you are in the level of competition with these people, but took long time.
How good was Ronnie Peterson? I was a huge Ronnie Peterson fan also.
Ronnie really was very, very fast. Ronnie was, I remember driving the March, the works March, it was very, very quick. Ronnie always was very, very fast, you know. And Ronnie and I started the same age, and I started at the same time, but always was very, very quick. Always, everybody was very much in love with Ronnie, very much, yeah.
Okay, a Formula One debut in 1972 from pole position on home ground. The crowd must have gone crazy, and I was at the track yesterday to visit the place. What do you remember most from that weekend?
Yeah, the start in Formula One was in 1972. Really, I start in Formula One in the Race of Champions in October 1971. Was the Race of Champions in Brands Hatch. And I race him with the Brabham BT33 together with Graham Hill. Graham was in the other Brabham, in the BT34. So I race him in Brands Hatch. And the day I started Formula One in Brands Hatch was the day Joseph Schiffer died in an accident.
with a BRM. That was my first race in Formula One. And in the meantime, end of 71, Bernie Ecclestone bought Brabham, the factory Brabham, from Black Brabham and Ron Turner. So I started in Brabham in 1972, and I drove here in Argentina the Brabham BT34, Graham Hughes in Brands Hatch in October 71. So I started here in Argentina with the BT34, and I made the pole position with very soft set of tires, very soft.
Now, was that your idea or the team's idea to get...
No, the qualifying with... I think everybody qualified with the soft tires. And I make the pole position. I knew the circuit number 9 very well. But I make a very good lap, and I started from the pole position. I think Bernie took the decision to run me with a soft compound for the race. I think the tire was too soft for the race. I think Jackie using the hard compound, and I think he made the right choice. And I think Bernie said, okay, first time in your country, pole position, and run the soft tires, but I can keep the pace with the soft tires, you know. I lose a lot of grip with a lot of laps. I think I finished 7th, something like that, but I can keep the pace of the front runner with it. When the tires lose grip, lose a lot of grip anyway.
Now, one thing I noticed about your career, and being a big fan of your career, is you won 3 times in neighboring Brazil. One of the victories was Michelin's first win.
Yeah.
But you always missed out on home ground once you ran out of fuel. And I remember once you were on the podium, and it was your birthday, if I remember correctly.
Yes.
And the band played Happy Birthday with trumpet and all that. Did you get extra motivation or extra 6/10 as Alonso would bring to a team when you raced on home ground?
That race in 81 was really... When I started in Europe in 1970, I started in Hockenheim in Formula 2. And I started the day of my birthday, 12 April 1970. And the race in Argentina was 12 April 1981. And I finished behind, I think Piquet won the race.
And they were helped by the...
That was the year, the 81 was the year of the big problem between the right heights, yeah, in the pits and in the... One right height in the pits and in the track, everybody using the car. It's the low, very low, to make ground effect.
I think Hector Rabach also passed,
yes,
you.
Hector Rabach was running behind Piquet, and that was a system, an intelligence system. Gordon Murray make it. I never understood how he worked. I think in the pit was very high, and when the car went into the track, the car taking very low right height and using the ground effect. It took a long time for the other teams to find out the way. I think William make another way around with the hydraulic system to make the car low, mm-hmm, to using the ground effect. But I think the man who starting first was Murra with the Brabham. Rebacke was second at one, yeah, time of the race. But
yeah,
this car was very fast, very, very fast car.
Yeah. Okay, now South Africa, 74. I was 15 years old, but I remember this day very well. Your first Grand Prix win in a Brabham. This was also the first Grand Prix win for an Argentine driver since Fangio's famous win at the Nürburgring in 1957. How does this victory stand in your memory compared to my own personal favorite Reutemann victory at Brands Hatch in 1978?
Yeah,
In the race, I was very close to one in Argentina in 1974 with the Brabham BT-44. Mm-hmm. That Brabham Gordon Murray make was very quick car, very fast, very, very fast. And I remember in 1974, I was leading the race in Argentina for a margin of something like 25 seconds or 27. In front of Denny Hulme, and it's 2 laps to go. They start to misfire in the engine, and I stop in the last lap. 1 lap to go, and running out of fuel. I think.
How upset were you?
Running out of fuel. No more fuel. Using all the fuel. I think using 33 gallons, all the fuel. I remember after the car was in the pits, we took the car and pumping the fuel out, and won a glass of 200 centimeter of fuel. So I think it was a miscalculation of the fuel consumption.
How upset were you? And did Bernie fire?
Very bad, because it was very easy. It was 1 lap to go, with a lot of margin, with the boot of the first 44 in my country. And always, all the Argentinians, until today, remember the day I running out of fuel, but anyway. Not enough fuel in the tank to finish the race.
Did Bernie...
So the next race was South Africa with the 44, and the car again was very, very quick, and was a very nice race, and the car was very fast. The BT-34 was very fast in the straight, and was a nice race to win, I think 1 month later. But Argentina was so easy to win, because it was 1 lap to go with 27 seconds in front, very easy.
Did Bernie fire somebody on the spot?
I think it was a lot of problem with the... that morning, I think the mechanic find out a problem to take the wheel away from the car and to change the right rear wheel, took all the suspension away, took the upright and the rear suspension, and it took a lot of time to do the job. And I think, according with Gordon at the time, Gordon said, we never took all the fuel away from the car from the morning warm up to the race and checking how much fuel was the consumption, because it spent too much time. I think it took 1 hour to try to take the wheel away, and after took all the upright with the right suspension, everything, to change the wheel of the car, took all the rear suspension, and it took a long time, and I think he never checked the consumption of the car for the race. This is according with Gordon Murray, who was starting at the time. Brabham took Bernie took Brabham from the factory, from Jack Brabham.
Now, Gordon Murray designed beautiful cars, and he himself came from South Africa. How was he to work with? Was he a pretty good guy to work with, easy guy?
Very good. And the BT-44 was a very impressive car. Everybody, when they see the car for first time, was very impressive. How small was the car, and how nice construction, how the construction of the car, the fine engineering of the car, I think... Everybody was very impressive with the car. I think Gordon was very, very good designer.
And the car had beautiful Martini colors. I love those.
The year after, the 1975, when he put the Martini color, was very impressive. The Martini colors, the white car with the Martini colors, make a big impression.
The red one was also beautiful.
The red one was the Alpha. The Alpha, the Brabham Alpha, that was, I think, 1976. The red column for the Italian country, and with the Martini colors in the side, was very nice. Both.
Talking of Alfa Romeo engines, did you get a chance to work with Carlo Chitti? He was quite a character.
Yeah, I raced once...
made one or two races with the Alpha Protocol. I think it was in 1975-76. I raced one time in Nürburgring in the long track, and after I raced in Austria. And the Alpha I drove in Austria, I have a problem in the inside the track. It took fire, the car. And so some problem with the fuel line. And that was the engine after using in Formula One. I used in the engine in prototype. And the engine was a very powerful engine. But I think the engine have... the power in very small amount of revs. I remember was needed using a lot of revs all the time to keep the engine very a lot of performance. I think after Alpha took the change the diagram of the power of the engine to using for Formula One. But Kitty was I knew Kitty before and was very passionate about racing. He loved racing a lot.
You did some sports car racing also. Did you enjoy sports car racing?
Yeah, I did few races with Ferrari, with the 312T, the P. I think I raced in Roma, in Watkins Glen. I did two or three Le Mans. I think Le Mans 1973, I think.
Did you enjoy sports car racing?
Not that much that compared with Formula One. No. But Formula One was much precise.
Now we talked about Bernie Ecclestone. He is Mr. Formula One, as we all know.
Yes.
Has he ever sent you an email or a text message saying, "Hey, Carlos, it's only $30 million, and that is with X employee discount. I can bring a GP to Santa Fe or any other town in Argentina"?
When I stopped racing, I asked Bernie to organize the GP, the Formula One GP in Argentina. And always Bernie refused to speak about that. He said, "No chance, you're going to lose so much money, this is impossible to do it." So no was any chance to organize the Formula One race in Argentina. I'm talking about 1983, 1984, something like that. And Bernie was very, very refused, because he said there's no possibility to make any money about the race. And I think the race came in Argentina in 94 or 95. And I think the organizers make the race 1 year or two and lose so much money that... stop racing in Argentina. That was the reason stop organizing the Formula One in Argentina. I think organizing in 94 or 95, I don't remember, but lose so much money.
Now, recently there have been talks about it might come back as a street race in Buenos Aires, and Argentina has a great track, Potreros de los Funes. Do you think that track can hold a Formula One race?
I think it's possible to make the race in Argentina, or you make the race here in Buenos Aires. I think the track in Buenos Aires is fair. It's okay for Formula One. Potrero is okay, but I think the problem to bring the race is the people who organize is a lot of 20 countries organize Formula One races now, and I think a lot of people are in the waiting list for organizing races. I think Argentina needed to be in the queue of the new organizers, put in the queue, plus to have, I don't know how many million dollars you need to organize the race, 50 million, 60 million, 80 million. I don't know.
Okay, your
Couture is very expensive.
Oh, yeah.
Couture is very expensive. More expensive it is, more difficult to organize it is, because it's very difficult to make money with the race.
Yeah. Your country was strongly represented in Formula One in the 50s. Now it's been 30 years since your last victory at Zolder as a last Argentine win. What will it take to see the next Lole? Are there any young prospects who are F1 material?
Yeah, I think it's very difficult today to put up a driving in Formula, because it's very difficult to find out the money to finance the arrival of the driver in Formula One. I think it was very close. Pechito Lopez was very close 2 or 3 years ago, very close, and he's a very good driver. But I think it was a problem with the find out money to pay for the seat. This is the only reason. I think Argentina have a lot of potential very good drivers, no problem. But the problem is to find out $10 or $20 million to find out the seat.
You know, you mentioned Severe, Peterson, Siffert, all unfortunately died in accident. Two of your teammates were killed also, Carlos Pache in a plane crash and Gilles Villeneuve at Zolder. Can you talk a little bit about these two drivers as teammates and friends?
Yeah, both. Pache was very, very quick. Very quick driver, very was very quick all the time, and it was very impressive because Pache died in the accident in the plane, so nothing to do with racing. Villeneuve is a different case because I was racing in Ferrari in 1977 when Gilles arrived in Formula One. So I spent a lot of time with Gilles in the winter of 77 and 78 together in Fiorano in Ferrari. We drove a lot of miles testing Michelin tires, make a lot of miles during the winter. So I make a good relationship with Jill, and I think was a very nice guy, very nice, very impressive, very fast, and I think Jill. I think in one stage, Jill. I think in Ferrari makes some situation with Gilles and Pironi after Gilles died. I think Gilles was an accident, incredible accident in Zolder in 1982. But I think after the problem with Pironi in the race before in Imola, Gilles was very upset about how Ferrari reacting in the race in Imola. But I probably was the Formula One man who I make more friendly. You understand? I was very close with him because we spent too much time together. And still coming from Canada and coming from a new life, what was Formula One. So all the time Jill asking about questions, about circuit, about a lot of things. So I make a very good relationship with Jill. And so I was very, very impressed with the accident of Jill, because I knew Jill very well. What for me was like 50% friend and 50% a son.
Really?
Yeah. Because all the time he making questions about this or that all the time. Very nice guy.
Yeah. You know, it's nice to see his picture when he won the first race in Montreal, and you were also on the podium.
Face. See, he won the race in 1978, no?
78.
He ran the Michelin Brin 2 or 3 different compounds, him with Tomaini, run the soft compound. It was a very cold day in Canada. And this one in Canada was very, very nice for us because he wants to home Grand Prix. No? Always everybody wants to win his home race.
Okay, 1978, you won both the U.S. races, West U.S. Grand Prix West Long Beach and the East at Watkins Glen in the beautiful Ferrari 312 T3, which is one of my favorite cars. What was your impression of American racing scene and American fans?
So, you know, well, the Glen, the Long Beach was very, very impressive, the area of Long Beach, the Queen Mary, all the infrastructure of the area was very impressive. California, everything was very impressive. Sí, Long Beach está en California.
Yeah. And Watkins Glen, did you like that place?
Watkins Glen was a very special place because I think it was in the autumn of the States in October. Very impressive, the tree with the color of the tree. The track is very nice. It was very, very nice. We have a big impression with the accident of Sever in the Glen. In the SS in the back, but anyway, it was a circuit, very, very nice track, very nice, very fast, very nice corner, left, right, up and down, very natural track, very, very nice, very nice.
From 1970 to 74, a lot of racing drivers were killed. Was there ever any pressure from your family or on your own that maybe I should quit this?
No, but you know, the impression you have today in Formula One, you don't see this amount of accident. Or if you see an accident today, the car is so safe, the material is so strong, it's no more fire in Formula One. The runoff area is very big. So the last big accident, I think, the big impression we get was with Ayrton in 1994. It's a long time ago. But at our time, was normal have an accident every year, one or two every year. So you have Rin, Courage, Seifer, Ronnie, Williamson, Tom Price. You know, the material was different material. Was a lot of problem with the fire because the tanks were on the side. I think the big improvement of the car was when you put in the tank in the back of the driver. So you get a big impression when was a accident where somebody close to you was killed. You know, it's today not happen more in Formula One, but in our time, that was a hard time to live with.
Now, you mentioned Pechito Jose Maria Lopez, this US F1 debacle. Did you have any dealings with on this program with your ex-manager, Peter Windsor?
Peter once called me about this project, and the only question he asked me, he ran one time, and I said, he asked me about how good was Pechito Lopez. If, in my opinion, Lopez was in position to drive in a Formula One. And I said, the guy make a very good impression. I think have the ability to drive in a Formula One. But about his project, about the project of his Formula One within the States, I really never took contact with the people organizing. I never knew anything about this project, no idea. The only question I answered was about the condition of Lopez. like a racing driver, but all the organization or how the people organizing to make a Formula, I never knew nothing about that, no.
But given your experience, and you're a very smart, knowledgeable person, given your experience and you're smart and knowledgeable, did you really think a project based in North Carolina will succeed?
No idea about that. No, I never knew. First, I don't know the place. I don't know the people. I don't know nothing. I have no idea about that. No, I repeat, the only question I answer to Windsor is about the condition of Lopez, about the structure of the team, how the team organized, where the team was based, who was behind the team, who put the organization. No idea. No idea about nothing. The only answer was about Pechito. That's it. Who was a lot of problem in Argentina, because Windsor come to Argentina and talking about the project. So after the project went down, was a lot of answer with no, a lot of questions with no answers in Argentina. But I never was involved in the project. No idea about that. No idea. No idea.
Is Peter Windsor's visa to Argentina still valid?
No. I think he come one to Argentina and explain to the people what happened, but I really don't know. No, I can't answer because I don't know.
Okay, now one question I'm sure you can answer.
I know was in North Carolina.
Okay, one question I'm sure you can answer. Ferrari team, you were there, and you know you always hear politics at Ferrari. What was your experience, and how was your relation? You speak Italian, I would imagine. How was your relationship with Signor Enzo Ferrari and Mr. Mauro Forghieri?
I was in a hard time with Ferrari because 1977 and 78, the time I was in Ferrari, was the time of the starting of the ground effect. So 1978, we fighting against the Lotus 79 of Chapman, the ground effect, you know, of the new era is the Lotus 79. The cars Mario, I think, started solding in 1978, was a fantastic car. It's the car of the new generation of the ground effect. So for us to fight in against that technology was very tough. Is the new generation of technology, the ground effect, the Lotus 79. So in 1978, against that technology, I won four races with the Ferrari, with the T3. But anyway, it was I think Mario won six. I won four. But in Ferrari, in the Ferrari, the only way to be success is if you win all the time. Yeah. It's not too much answer in Ferrari. You need to make result all the time. Now, I think at the time Ferrari was leaving, I think was much harder. Very tough.
I remember
Ferrari was all the time in command of the, you know, of the team also. It was a very tough time.
But how was your relationship in dealing with Mr. Ferrari?
All the time I was in Fiorano, Ferrari was very nice, invite to the house in Fiorano, sometimes went to eat al ristorante El Cavallino. He have a fantastic relationship with Gil. Very nice, very impressive. I think he treat Gil like a grandson.
Yeah.
All the time, was very, very happy with Gil. You see in his face how happy was Enzo with Gil all the time. He treated like a grandson.
Yeah, there's a picture of him kissing his head. It's so beautiful. 78 French Grand Prix, you made a lot of pit stops, and because you guys were on Michelin.
In the Castellet.
Yeah.
So I think make 5 pit stops. Yeah, we make so many pit stops because I tried to test for Michelin in Le Castel. It was very hot. And him, Dupasquier said, okay, we tried to make this race like a testing for tires. I think I made 5 pit stops.
But you had the fastest lap.
Yeah, I make the fastest lap because I have a new set, very soft, and I make a very fast lap.
Okay. I asked Jackie this question because he had driven for Italian teams and British teams in racing. You've done the same. Who has more passion for motor racing, British people or Italian?
No, I don't understand.
Who has more passion for motor racing, British people or Italian people?
Yeah, you know, I think the Italian people are passionate, are big passion only, not only for motor racing, are big passion for football, for the sport, for motorbike, for Valentino Rossi, for Giacomo Agostini, for, you know, but the people, the British people, is the country where the engineering of Formula One are. You know, the British people this engineering of making Formula One is coming from Britain. And one case, very special case, is when Ferrari took John Barnard to Maranello. So this is a British team arriving in Italy. And Barnard, I think, made the antenna in Guildford, no? So that was the beginning of an Italian team become British. When Barnard arriving in Italy was the beginning of Britain arriving in Italy to making a Formula a racing car.
Okay, Jacques Repagua.
This is my view. This is my special point of view.
Yeah, we appreciate that. Okay, Jacques Repagua, 1981. Williams 1-2, led by Carlos Reutemann. You are happy, I am happy, but the team and your teammate are not happy. And a lot has been written about this in the press. What is your side of the story, por favor? Did you or did you not see the pit signals?
Yeah, I see the sign, but this, I think, If I drop the throttle to leave the race, give the race away, it's better to stop motor racing. No was any reason to continue to motor racing anymore.
That
was the only reason.
Okay. Now, was that in the contract?
I think that was the beginning of the bad situation we live in all 1981 in the team, because everybody was upset. Jones was upset, Head was upset with me, William was upset, but anyway, c'est la vie.
Yeah. Question, was that in your contract that you were number two?
Yes, yes. I think in the contract was if Jones was 6 or 8 seconds behind. 6 or 8, I don't remember very well. I think 6 or 8.
Okay.
If I was in front and the margin was 6 or 7 seconds, I agree to Jones pass me in the race. Yeah.
Okay, the other was Las Vegas 1981. You were leading the championship into final season. Started the race from pole. What went wrong with the car there? What happened there?
I think in the championship of 81, I don't lose the championship in the last race. This is the end of the history. But I think we start to lose the championship every race since William changed from Michelin to Goodyear. Because at the time we are with Michelin, I make about 41 points or 42, I don't remember, I need to see the book. With Michelin I make about 42 points.
And since we raced with Woody, I make 6 points.
No.
I think it took long time for William to understand how the Woody are working in the car. The day went tried to Silverstone, took Michelin away and put Goodyear in the car, I think Brabham was 1.5 seconds faster than William. I think the Goodyear was much better for Brabham compared with Williams. William worked very hard to adapt the Goodyear to the car. Took long time. So Las Vegas in the end of the history, but the race before in Canada was a complete disaster in the rain. I have a lot of problems with it all the time with the performance of the car compared with William with Michelin and compared with Woody, the performance was completely different.
But as far as the last question on this, as far as the Vegas race is concerned, was there a problem with the car or with the tire that you did not even finish on
no,
the points?
I normally drove one chassis in practice in Las Vegas. I think it was chassis 14 or 12. 14 or 12. But was handling very well. And in the Saturday morning practice or Friday afternoon, I think I touched Nelson with the car, and I bent one fan upright, and after this problem the car never handled the same, so I choose the other car for the race, and that car never was exactly the same. That's it.
Okay, now one thing
plus,
that
plus we have a lot of problem with find out the exact set of quick tires. At that time was a lot of problem with the diameter of the tires. One set of tires was quick, one set of tires make you understeering, another set make oversteering. Was a big problem with the diameter of the rear tires. A lot of problem.
Now, I read in one of your interviews, you were asked, why did you not put Piquet in the wall to win the championship? And we've seen that happen many times.
No.
And you said you did not want to win that way. You still feel the same way?
Yeah, I think Piquet was... I think Piquet started the race in Las Vegas with a lot of attention about this problem, because he had this problem the year before in Canada. So I think Piquet was thinking very much in the possibility somebody took off him from the race. But anyway, I never think it in that possibility.
Yeah. No, that's good. Okay, 1982, you started the season with a podium finish, and after the second round you said no mas. What was the main reason for walking away from a competitive car?
Why? Because I raced the year before in 1981 in Jacare Paua. And I knew how I feel in 1981 in Jacare Paua, in the same track, in Rio de Janeiro, in the same place. And I knew how I feel in the year after, in 1982, on both day and night.
Really?
So when I find out what day and night and was the same place, the same track, the same sun, the same Ipanema, the same, everything the same, and I find out my feeling was absolutely different compared with the year before. I think something. So I think the big mistake I make in 1982 was staying Williams for another year. I think the only chance for me was jumping to another team and racing in 82 with a new team. Any team.
Was that a possibility?
I think was the possibility. Any team. I think the team who ran in last.
Okay.
No problem. But I think in after the big mistake was coming back to the same place. I lose the championship with 1 point. That was the big mistake.
Okay.
Well, anyway, William won the 82 the championship with Keke.
Did that bother you?
Yeah, no. But for myself, was better for change the climax.
Yeah. Good. Okay, now, I'm coming to the last few questions. You raced and won against some of the best, Jochen Rindt, Mario Andretti, Peterson, Philippe Hardy. In the time you were racing, who would you select as your two drivers if you were a team owner in the time, in the decade you raced in Europe? And this is my favorite question to racing drivers. What I want to know is, who are the best two drivers when you raced, apart from you?
When I raced?
Yes.
At the time I raced, who was the best at the time?
Two of the best, apart from Carlos Reutemann.
If I was to pick up two to race in my team, I pick Clark and Rindt.
Jim Clark and Jochen Rindt. Yes. Can't argue on that. Okay. Latin America has produced many great racing drivers. One of them won the Mercedes Celebrity Race at the revised Nürburgring in 1984. You were in that race.
Yes.
In the rain. Tell me about that race and the winner, young winner, please.
I remember the race with the Mercedes 190 in Nürburgring. And I finished third. And I remember one Mercedes 190 overtook me very easy.
Did you know who it was then?
No. So I said, "Christ, this guy is quick, is good." And that guy was Ayrton Senna.
Did you get to know him personally later in life?
No, not very much, no. But the guy was very so fast, and nothing. It was very impressive, and the guy was Senna, so Senna was brilliant guy, brilliant rider.
Okay, your favorite racing track, and what did you think of Rouen, where you raced in Formula 2?
Well, it's a natural track. I like natural tracks like Brands Hatch, Spa. I don't like the new tracks in the world now, the new era of the Formula 1. I think the tracks are very too artificial. I think I like tracks, natural tracks, like I love Brands Hatch, I love Spa-Francorchamps, up and down with natural corner. I don't like too much from outside. I never race in the new tracks, but the new track look like it's a computer design the corner.
Brands Hatch.
What in Glen is another natural track. Natural track.
Will you please?
Maybe the new this is. I'm talking about my generation. Maybe the new generation of people driving today in Formula One love the new track, because a lot of drivers now start to drive with the PlayStation. So driving the PlayStation in this type of track, you understand? I think we can't miss the generation. One generation is Stefano, another generation is my generation, and this generation probably, because started driving with the PlayStation, love this type of track.
I have yet to hear one young driver say Bahrain is better than Spa or Suzuka. It won't happen.
No.
Yeah. Okay, now very important.
The new drivers complaining about the new tracks or the design are very safe, but the corners are very, very strange.
Nothing like Eau Rouge.
No.
Yeah. Okay, you mentioned Brands Hatch. Will you please tell our listeners in your own words what happened in the closing stages of the 1978 British Grand Prix, one of my favorite races?
You know, 1978, I was very lucky. A lot of people in front of me broke the engine or broke the, I don't know what broke, anyway.
But you passed your ex-teammate.
Yes, but anyway, and in the end was a big fighting with Lauda was very fast. I think Lauda was very fast in the, I overtook Niki with Giacomelli in the middle. I think I passed inside and Lauda outside, I don't remember. I think when I went inside, Lauda was outside, something like that. and him was leading the race, and normally when you arrive into back marker, probably this problem happened. It's more easy the guy coming behind to see the hole to go in. But anyway, I was very lucky. I took the right decision, took the right, and him took the left, and I took the lead for 2 or 3 seconds and something like that. But was 5 or 6 laps to go, and after Nicky came very fast and was very close. I think 2 or 3 more laps, and I was in trouble.
Was Ferrari team really happy you beat the guy who walked away from them?
No, Ferrari no was very lot of emotion at that time. I think we have a lot of problems in 1978 in the middle of the year against the ground effect, against the tires, against the different compound, different. Was a hard time. Middle of 78 was a hard time.
Last question is the most important. Your daughter Cora has a young son. If someday he comes to you and say, "Grandpa, what did you do in racing? What top 3 achievements you will be proud to tell him?"
I think it's going to be difficult to him to understand what happened with me, because it's a lot of difference in age.
But if he was
absolutely crazy about helicopters, so I really don't know. He's crazy about helicopters, so all day, every day, I play helicopter, and he's very happy when I see flying the helicopter and all the time. But it's crazy about helicopters.
But you know,
but he's 2 years old. The most important thing is to arrive in Formula One. And for me, the most important thing is to go out alive. Because in my generation, about 17 guys died from my starting to the end. Start with Jochen Rindt in 1970, or Pierre Courage in 1969. Follow Seifert, follow Revson, follow Williamson, follow Sever, follow Bonnier, Helmut Koenig, 17.
If there was one race you could race one more time that you won, which one would that be?
Race again, one race.
Yes.
Pick up my race, or if I like,
your race.
My race, Barkhart.
78. Okay, great. Thank you so much for your time. Finally, we have a lot of listeners in South America, everywhere. Would you like to say a message to them, please?
No, South American people are very big fan of motor racing. It's a lot of fun. A lot of people follow motor racing, and it's a lot of people racing in Argentina in different categories. Small, big, in the country, in rallies, it's a lot of people fan of motor racing. It's a big passion in Argentina, motor racing, very big passion. Okay.
Muchas gracias.
Muchas gracias.
Great honor to meet you.
Carlos Reutemann, thanks for joining F1Weekly.com.